Welcome to Missing the Mark, where we look for meaning in strange places. I'm Christopher.
Welcome. Today I'm talking with Ed Lattimore, who's a professional boxer, author, veteran. I run a Twitter account with over 10,000 followers now. And I feel like I'm missing something, even though I just went over it. But anyway, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me. I just said welcome back. Let me say hello, hello, and... Habits, man.
Yeah, no, I understand. As I mentioned before, something I'm really interested in talking with you about is making wisdom, life lessons, whatever you want to call it, intelligible. Because, I follow you on Twitter, and you have a very interesting style, and you talk a lot about, I hate the term self-improvement, but in any event, it's just so trite. It's accurate, just very trite. Yeah. all decent people are striving to become better versions of themselves. Yourself you're supposed to be, but it's a trite word anyway. But that being said, it still applies because it's accurate. And so, that does seem to be a lot of what you talk about. And so I want to talk about that subject of how you make this intelligible to people who don't already know it and don't already understand. The first question actually is, do you have a sense of who your audience is composed of at all?
Informally, I know that for whatever reason, people seem to be, I think it depends on when you catch me. It's so funny. People only see the growth of my account because that's what they show. They don't show the losses. because I probably lose about 15 followers a day, but I'm gaining about 25 to 30. So that's up and down. And I bring that up in reference to your question. The person that follows me and follows me short-term versus long-term, a short-term person will just see something I write about or a thought trail I'm on at that particular moment. The long-term person values my thought process in general. So they may not agree or care for some of the things I say or discuss, but they value the way I think about and the way I express myself. Those are the people that stick around forever. Those are a majority of the now 12,000 so odd people that follow me. But then, someone will follow me because I said something maybe related to my relationship and how in love I am. And then the next thing I'm talking about, like how stupid certain social movements are or something that might be construed as racist or sexist. And they're like, this guy, I got to get out of here. I did a thread the other day. I was in a barber shop getting my hair cut. And I'm just popping off things my barber said. And my barber's a dude from the hood. He did like 10 years in jail, man. He's a real dude. So I think I lost like 15 people during that. Because these are people that follow me based on one thing. And then they see there's another side, and maybe they don't like that side. So that's how that goes. Now, as far as taking ideas and, putting them into a form for people to take, that's just, there was a grid I put on Instagram. It goes, what is writing, right? There was simple, complicated, honest... Are honest or not honest, and you always want to aim in the simple side. The ones on the right weren't good, but if you can make a thing simple, then you can get it through to as many people as possible. I guess if you want to, and it might not seem this way, but I think this is the goal of good writing in general. Certainly my goal on Twitter, my goal, my blog, and my blog continues to improve. I mean, you look at some of the old posts, even with me cleaning them up, and they still don't compare to, I think, what is the best thing I put out, which was the last thing I put out, which is a very simple, powerful, bop, 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 read through, you get it, there's a flow to it, but there's no extra words. I try to reduce the extra words, I try to reduce redundant adjectives, I try to say what I mean clearly, and I like to reduce the word "and." Not a big fan of the word "and," etc. So what that does when I do all of that, and it's what I try and do with my Twitter as well, with the exception of I try to add a rhythm if I can. If you can always add a rhythm to the words, even better. is that the message is riding the lowest frequency, the lowest common denominator, so anyone can get it. It doesn't appeal to one specific group. Now, sometimes it has to or it does, but even then you can extract some piece of wisdom or perspective from it and apply it to everything else. And I think that is, that's my goal, to make sure that when I'm expressing myself, that it comes across clear. If I could, like, and that's why Twitter's great, right? Because Twitter forces you to be succinct, 140 characters. You know what I mean? You gotta work with it, man. And I have learned to work with it, and that has made me a better communicator in other realms. My blog pieces are getting shorter, but they're communicating more. Just like if you want to survive on Twitter, and I think, you know, all the recent censorship aside, which I'm not sure how I feel about it either way, because I see the arguments on both sides, but my opinion on censorship isn't what I'm really expressing right now. I think that the key to excelling on Twitter, because it's a great tool, some people say it's just Twitter, I think it's a great tool to reach and spread a message. The key to excelling on that, to getting as many people into your message and to share what you say, whether your message is good or bad, the key is simplicity. If you can make it simple, it's catchier. It doesn't go over people's heads. It gets shared because people don't like to think, right? It's not that people aren't capable of thinking, but it's like people don't like to run. I mean, it's anything. People like to conserve energy. So I don't want to be a strain on somebody's feed. I want to try to be a net positive. I want people to encounter my feed and encounter what I say and go, man, you know, my day is plus because of that. Not minus and not neutral, but plus. And you do that, you give more value than you take, and it grows. I mean, and Twitter's been great for me because of that.
Now, what have you found about, like, the balance? Because Twitter's interesting in terms of humor. Mm-hmm. An interesting example, a tweet I had recently where I actually sort of had certain things in mind, but it was one where it said, I can't remember the exact wording, but essentially, you know, put your full trust in God or else in nobody, but human beings simply aren't an option. And it wasn't perfectly clear that I mean that go ahead and trust people, just always remember that people are fallible. And so, you know, they're just trying to be succinct. I think I went a little overboard in being a little too succinct that, because it's something I've observed, it's something I've mentioned in various places, like, if you need people to be perfect in order to love them, you don't love anybody. You only love the ideas of them in your head. Because real people all have flaws. Real people will hurt you. Real people will let you down. And the only way you're ever going to actually, you know, love people is if you can love them despite the fact that occasionally they will hurt you. So that's sort of what I was trying to get across. I didn't do a great job with that one. You know, I think some people might have gotten it, some people not. I didn't do a great job there of being widely intelligible. I was also trying to be not like ha-ha funny, but like slightly humorous there. And so I'm using this as an example of where humor needs to be succinct. Humor has to have something like a punchline. But there's always the danger whenever you're being very succinct, or, you know, having a punchline that has any sort of, you know, twist to it, it can be very easy to lose people, like, where they won't realize it's a joke and so on. So, using that just as an illustration of the pitfalls of humor, especially in a written medium, where people can't catch body language, like, how have you navigated that? Like in, you know, well, changing thoughts over time?
Two or three ways. I was just counting some stuff off while you were talking, particularly about what you were saying. So we'll just say two or three ways, and then if there are more, there certainly won't be less. Number one, I view the medium, even though I understand it now, I still view the medium as a representation of my entire being. Why is it significant to say that? Because I did the math, and looked at some successful tweets or some non-successful tweets, some trends over the past 3 years, and the conclusion I have come to, this is going to blow your mind, is that any given tweet is seen by 1 to 3% of your total follower audience. That means that even, and that's just like between an hour apart. That's why if you notice, I don't know how close you follow me, but I'll retweet ideas, man, because I know that people just don't see them enough, right? There's no reason, but like a measure of success for an account of my size, like that's how you can tell my account isn't fake, is at 12,000 followers, I should be getting 100 or so retweets and likes on average. That's crazy, though, when you think about what that means. That means I should be doing less than 1% of my follower base.
Yeah.
But that's the belly of the beast. So you have to remember that it is though it is discrete that way, that you put something out, it's there, and it's done. And because it's chronologically ranked, like Twitter doesn't show people your stuff more because more people liked it. It's just boom, you put it out, that's the order it came in. There it is. You got to remember that. So I view my personality still through the lens of a collective window, which is why some people unfollow me when they see other parts, whatever. And I'm like, that's cool. Because I don't want to think that much about it, and I don't think it's constructive. I want people to see all parts of me. Because ultimately, if you read my writing and become a fan, that's what I want. I want fans. I want people that like all the things, or most of the things, or at the very least respect the thought process. So that's number one. Number one is remember that the medium treats you discreetly, but you should probably see yourself as a continuous representation. With that said, two, stay on theme. Stay on theme in a simple theme. So I was sitting there thinking about the example you gave. And then you know what you did? You did the most beautiful thing. You started saying it in better ways as you were talking. It's just natural. You communicate and you use the theme naturally, or you use the tool naturally. You got to remember, it's just an extension of your communication. So there's no need to modify it for a specific audience. And you don't want to because of point one. Point one is that you want to view yourself continuously. Holistically is a better way to look at it. You want to view yourself as a whole, not the parts they chop you up into on Twitter. That will alleviate the mental stress you may experience trying to put out a catchy piece of wisdom or interesting stuff. Because when you're just talking, look, my girlfriend will tell you all the time, and I see this all the time when people ask me, man, how do you come up with this stuff? I'm like, you don't understand. I'm literally talking into Twitter sometimes. Like, there were numerous times she's like, how did you tweet that? I didn't even see you tweet that. You were just saying that to me. Because all it is just my thinking. And that's why I say that being limited to 140 characters has vastly improved my ability to communicate, because it's made my communication simple and direct. This is one of the, probably one of a few, if not the only instances, and maybe that's just me and not everyone else I can speak for, but the medium of digital communication has improved my in real life communication, because I'm not always thinking consciously, man, let me cook this up for Twitter, but I hear things through Twitter. Like you said the tweet about, you know, you don't depend on people, or at least depend on people to the degree of which they're infallible. God's the only one that's infallible. And you said it so beautifully in so many different ways afterwards. You were like, you know, if you want to love people, you got to love them knowing that they can hurt you. I heard that and that stuck with me. And I'm saying, man, I'd go tweet. I'd leave right here and tweet that, right? You should tweet it just like that, because that's how you said it. Notice I didn't like, we didn't sit down in the lab or something and go, all right, man, you got this, we're going to take it here. No, you got to make the, I tell people all the time, I live on the app. Like, I mean, I think the longest time I'm not tweeting, I don't remember, it's something related to communication or our travel. Like we drove up to Wellsboro, PA. So I wasn't on Twitter for like 4 hours driving. But once I got up there, I was like, man, I hope we got a signal, because there's going to be some cool stuff I can tweet about and talk about. And sure enough, I had a signal. So, but yeah, so I just make the app part of my communication. And I believe that it has made me a better communicator. You know, now maybe my communication sucks. Who knows? But the point is, that's how I feel. So everyone that follows me is getting that and they're digging that. So what was the main? So we got, remember to view yourself holistically. Stay on theme. You could put a rhythm behind it, man. That's beautiful. Like, and when I say rhythm, what I mean is that, so I can make this as you know, what is math? Math is all about good definitions, right? If you don't define a thing, you don't have a thing. So I don't want to leave you with an abstract term like rhythm. Your words should each sound unique with a, and there should be commonalities, or rather similarities, in the length and the amount of syllables per sentence. That is a beautiful definition. I just came up with that on the spot. So if you have a two-sentence tweet, right,
mm-hmm.
then they should be of about the same length because that's visually pleasing. And then they should have about the same syllables in each sentence because that's auditorily pleasing when they read it, when they hear the words being said back to themselves, when they see it, and they're like, that's a balanced tweet, you know. And then those are just like the basics. We haven't talked about spacing, list, or things like that. In other words, a person should see the tweet, and something about the structure of it before they even deal with the form should appeal. If you get the form, the structure, this is cool because I'm working on this Twitter god right now that I think a lot of people want to get value out of, particularly anyone that wants to use it for marketing. And these are like ideas I've thought about. Now that I'm like speaking them to you, I'm like hearing them out, and they're good. They're good. But so you want to design your message, and remember the medium you're dealing with. You're dealing with a visual medium. People are going to see it, and then they're going to see and hear it when they read it. And if it doesn't sound good, they won't do a thing with it. If it doesn't look good, they won't do a thing with it. But you've got to do all of that and still adhere to points 1 and 2.
Mm.
You still have to be simple and direct. You still have to be on theme. You still have to remember you are a whole representation. That's why engagement is so important, because people have to know it's you. I tweet on average, and this is by no means an endorsement or no means a recommendation for behavior. I tweet on average about 1,400 times per month. That's kind of, and I've learned that counts retweets, replies, etc. You know, I've known everything else in my life, so is it healthy or unhealthy? It's beyond the point. Point is, you know, my whole being is out there. So, you know, you got to remember, man, people are engaging with you. It annoys me so much, but it's just a basic fact of human nature. You know, I try to explain this to some other buddies. No one cares what you have to say until they like you. There's just no way around that. I wish it was the other way. It ain't the other way. So it's this way. So I have to work with this. And if I want to have an influence, if I want people to buy my book, if I want people to visit my website, they need to like me first. I can have the best life-changing advice, some like new way of looking at the world, some brand new self-improvement trick that'll make everybody get everything they want. But if I'm an asshole, no one's going to read it. Not only that, but they're going to tear it apart.
No, that's very true. It actually, I think it also dovetails nicely. Your most recent blog post was about being, did you use the term authentic? Or
yes, the power of the authentic life.
Yeah, and I mean, it's something, you know, in my own life, you know, I mean, I grew up generally disliked by my peers, which actually I found a very valuable experience, because it taught me to value other people's opinions of me only insofar as those opinions are correct. Because I got plenty of very obviously incorrect opinions about me as a kid. And so it taught me a lot of independence. And so, I mean, I'm fond of people, I like people, but when you can take or leave people, right. You know, and you know, if somebody likes my company, great. If not, God bless you, have fun somewhere else. That's something I myself found in life. I mean, we had very different circumstances. I grew up on Long Island. And,
okay.
In a very suburban sort of environment. So it was not, like, I didn't, you know, for those who don't know, do you want to, part of your story, this is a tangent, we'll get back to the other one, but it is, you have very much, your life seems to be a fairly good representation of, you know, the general American dream of starting starting from fairly little and making an awful lot of it so far. Granted, I'm putting you in a very awkward place by that sort of description.
But I mean,
do you want to give it just a few words about where you grew up?
So, you're not even from the area originally, so you're not familiar with some of the really bad areas, but I am from the worst areas in the city of Pittsburgh. Housing projects, I lived in two different ones, one from birth to non, the other from non to 18, where I went off to college for the first time, and I never went back. And the housing projects are as bad as they say. And I got lucky, right? By lucky, I mean I grew up in a housing project in Pittsburgh. The bigger the city, the rougher the project. And Pittsburgh is a big enough city, but it ain't like some place I imagine in New York City or Chicago or L.A. So there's that. I mean, it was by no means a picnic.
One of the posts you mentioned, I think you got into fights an average of like once a week.
Oh man, I fought all the time. I fought a lot until I made the conscious decision, and why I had the sense to make this decision, or that's another factor, but to go to a high school across town, and my life changed entirely, changed completely. I have all of the good friends I have now from childhood. I don't have a single friend from age 14. But all of the friends I have in my life now are people that I met in high school and people who were in a different life. And really, I became the victim of positive peer pressure because of who I was surrounded by, and I really could blossom and become a better human being. Now, I had a lot of lessons to learn in life, but I mean, we're talking about everyone wants to focus on making the right move, when in reality, I think your life will be not bad to above average if you just focus on not making the wrong ones. And I avoided some of the really big wrong ones. And that gave me time to focus on, at a later point, not immediately, but to focus on becoming better. Because look, I tell you what, now I can give you a lot of advice to self-improvement. I can give you all the self-improvement advice in the world, but if you're behind bars, good luck using it. We can talk about making extra money all we want to, but if you got four kids with child support, man, you got to figure out how to do this, and it ain't gonna be easy, and you're probably not gonna make enough quickly. So I could pursue boxing because I don't have extra kids, and I don't have a criminal record and stuff like that. Because I think those are the two big things that crush a lot of people from where I'm from, and a lot of young men in general. But mostly people where I'm from is getting in trouble with the law and premature children. Too young, especially if they do it with two different women. That's game over as far as I'm concerned. In fact, I ran a poll on this on Twitter, just hearing the guys' opinions. What is more difficult to come back from? Having a kid when you're like 16 and child support, or having a 7-year prison sentence and having a kid when you're younger, did edge out, but by a slight margin, just people's opinion. And it's just an opinion, boy. It's not like a fact or anything. But a lot of the reasoning behind it, I 100% agree with. Going to prison is bad, but it is a phase in life, and then when it's done, it's done. And if you learn from it, you're not going to go back. And there's ways to continue to improve your life, especially with skills they let you learn now in jail. Having a kid, I mean, you got to figure out how to keep yourself out of jail. That's the craziest part. You go to jail if you don't have a child, if you can't pay child support. You know, you're going to be run down and beat down. And on top of that, now you got to raise a life. And once you do that, you know, it gets really hard to create a superior life if you have to care for another one prematurely, especially when law enforcement gets involved. So
yeah, now children are. I have three children, young, oldest is 7, youngest is 1.5, and the amount they need is truly astonishing. I mean, if the mother and father aren't married, then their child support issues. Which is a topic I'm only very cursorily familiar with. But even in the case where you know, the mother and father are married, the amount of work children need, the amount of support, the amount of care.
To do it right. Everyone, you know, my cousins always, I'll have cousins ask, hey, when are you getting married? I'm like, or when, not when you get married. That would make too much sense. When are you having kids? I'm like, man, I can't afford that shit right now. And they're like, well, you can do it. We're doing fine. I'm like, okay, now I know not to respond when I can't afford it. Just, I'm not doing it. Because I think, look, the state is such that you can't have children without having money. That's not a good idea, but it can be done. I don't want that option. I want, you know, the woman I'm most certainly going to reproduce with, we've talked about what we want to be per child, and we have a number, but I guarantee, it isn't an extravagant number, but it's what we like to be after a certain point of time, and each of us, and that's the only way they're going to, because I'm fine without kids. I mean, well, worst case scenario, I grow up, become a dirty old man, right? But I would rather not. I'm pretty sure I want a family at this point. So now it's just finishing off some things that I want to get done.
Well, yeah, it's funny, not to digress too much on the subject of child raising, but there seem to me to be like three general approaches. One of them is purely accidental, so there's not much to say about it. One of them is like as a form of entertainment. Sort of. You know, you see this in, like, magazines and stuff, like, you know, having children, it fulfills you and makes your life, you know, wonderful, and you know, there are lots of glossy photos of smiling people. And the third one, which is the only one that makes any sense to me, is a bit like, well, a bit like joining the army, or my favorite, actually, in the Lord of the Rings movie, there's this wonderful scene where they're they see the tracks of an orc army, if I recall correctly, and then they run for the next, you know, then they chase it down running for like 36 hours straight, and finally catch up on it. Now, in the movie, they just cut, you know, 36 hours later, you know, they're panting and stuff, but, you know, they show up, and like, we finally caught them. And that is an amazing thing to have accomplished, and it's vaguely within the realm of what very fit human beings could possibly accomplish. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't want to fight for my life after 36 hours of running, but it's... At least human beings have done things like this in history, and not all drop dead. And these are two of them weren't even human, if I recall correctly, but at least one of them was. Because I think there's the dwarf, the elf, and the human, if I recall correctly. In any event, but, you know, this is an amazing thing. These are some badass characters, you know. They just ran 36 hours, and they're still ready to fight. Like, it's amazing, right? Imagine how much those, like, 36, 24, 36 hours, whatever it was, sucked. But that's what, you know, that's what being a parent is really like, because, you know, that child needs, you actually have to live through all of that time of getting up in the middle of the night and wrecking your sleep because a child needs something. And, you know, I mean, I've, you know, just last night I was woken up in the middle of the night because some child needed to go to the bathroom, and for some reason, you know, they're brain's not well enough developed to be able to, like, handle walking around in the dark on their own, so I have to go over and carry him over while his eyes are still not even awake. It's amazing what children can do without fully waking up, you know. And other, you know, they're sick, someone throws up in the middle of the night, gets to turn on the lights and clean up the vomit, and now the thing about this is actual human beings are benefiting from this work,
right?
You know, that's the thing in difference to, you know, stupid robot dolls, where who the hell cares? It's a doll. I mean, a human being you care about very greatly is benefiting from the fact you just cleaned up the vomit where they have to sleep. So it's worthwhile work. It's good work. I mean, somebody is really gaining a lot from what you're sacrificing. But you're signing up to sacrifice an awful lot, right? Because they've got nothing to give you yet. And they won't for many, many years. And I mean, that's not really the you know, the relationship of parent to child is you have a lot to give them, they have a lot of needs, so the two of you match up very well in that regard.
Yeah.
But it's pouring yourself out, you know, into another person, which, if you're in a position of strength, a position where you've got a lot to give, now you're going to make somebody that you can give it to, that makes sense to me. I mean...
And you won't be, you know, dead.
Well, yeah, you have to survive in order to still be able to give them more.
You know, like you were telling me you do programming. You're a programmer for a living. And I was like, that's great. So now you've got a skill, and you can work, and you can provide. I don't even know what your wife does, but that's just another person that to help and build and provide. And but if you had kids when you were like 17, what? Here's what we know for sure won't happen. You're not a programmer yet. You probably won't become one because you got to spend all this time and energy that you could use becoming one, but now you got to raise. And so now it snowballs, and next thing you know, you're 36 with no prospects in life, but you got some kids.
Yeah. So. Yeah, which isn't nothing, but it's all parents in some sense. I mean, we're all fallible, so we all fail the people we love most, a bit. I mean, we also, not in total, you know, we do a lot for them, you know, too. At least, you know, many people are able to give the people we love most, you know, some things. But frankly, one of the scariest things about being a parent is just the certainty that I'm going to screw up and my children will suffer for it. Because I'm fallible, I can't be perfect. And right. The only way they could escape without suffering for things that I screw up is if I was perfect. And that, it really sucks to know that and to have to face that. Like, but, you know, and this, I think, comes to something you've written about, too. Like, being able to face up to the fact that we're going to fail and just, you're going to have to deal with it and move on. And not let that knock you down forever.
Right. That's, yeah. People treat failure like it's some type of... like it's the end. They go, I failed, that's over, that's it. I'm like, nah. All failure is you tried to do a thing, and that thing didn't get you what you wanted, so now you gotta do another thing. That's it. Like, that's the simplest way to look at it. If you look at it in any other way, then one, it's arrogant, because it assumes that somehow you're going to figure out the thing the first time. Like, civilization is literally built on eons of people making mistakes. For you to somehow believe that you're gonna figure it out the first time is unbelievably arrogant. No, you gotta make mistakes, man. You gotta put, sweat equity, they call it? Part of sweat equity, yeah. Man. You gotta go out there, you could look stupid a few times. The analogy I always use, I love Dance Dance Revolution, man. I'm a huge fan of it. It sucks the Guitar Hero came out and people were like, nah, I'm going to just sit and play guitar instead of moving around. But if you wanted to get good at DDR, man, you had to be bad at DDR. And you couldn't be bad at DDR in the privacy of your own home. You had to like a fool in front of other people.
Yeah.
Right? But then when you get good at it, then you look I mean, I can't tell you the amount of crowds a big black dude doing DDR would draw in. But at first, I got to be a big black dude looking terrible at DDR. People were like, yeah, why are you playing it, etc., right? I like it. That's why, you know. So that's a silly example, but the point is still made that if you want to improve and excel and do well at something, you have to be bad at it first. And that entails making a lot of mistakes. And if you let the mistakes crush you, if you think the only way you're going to have a good life is to be perfect at a thing, then you will not have a good life. I can't think of anything. I mean, maybe you'll do great in like grade school handwriting. That's it. Well, good luck with the rest of life.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if modeling is a counterexample. You know, because, I mean, there are other people who do your makeup and other people who do your hair and people who put the clothes on you. So
I will say this. I don't know any models. Here's my counterexample to that. I think about this. So I'm a big fan of the scene. Every data set has an outlier. I think that's a much better way to say there's an exception to every rule. And that's just the stickler in me. So, to the data set of mistakes and getting better, the outlier on either end, There are some people that, like, man, no matter what, they just keep doing the same dumb shit, and they're not going to get better, and that's it. Those people usually end up in prison, and maybe they need that prison stuff, man, and good for them. On the other end, there are people that were born in the money or born with the genetics that they were with. We can put this person in the movie, and they're going to do great, and they're going to be models, and we can sell things based on the things they effectively had no control over. They won the genetic lottery, just so you know, right? If you were lucky to be born into that circumstance, great for you. I'm not gonna hate, man. That's the way to. I'm happy it turned out that way for you.
I apologize. It's something, you know, problem solving, you know, and professional problem solving, that's what programming is. So anytime I hear any sort of rule, and I'll do the same thing to myself too, any sort of rule, I start trying to think of, okay, there's got to be some exception somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? And you know, and I don't mean to, it can be a bad habit. I don't mean that, it doesn't vitiate anybody's point. The fact that, you know, 0.0001% of human beings could be a model, and maybe a model is an exception.
I think the exact same way. Because I find that if you can figure out the rules to a thing, if you can figure out the rules to a game, you got a much better chance of succeeding in the game. I think a lot of people just don't even know the rules of the game they're playing, and then you know they end up being back. They end up with a bad outcome. Mm. With that said, right? I think the rules apply 99% of the time.
Well, especially about hard, at least more than 99% for hard work.
For hard, like you won't go wrong following the rules. But poker is a great analogy for this, right? We got a rule in poker, right? The rule is never lead bet with 2-7 offsuit when you're playing the limit. If you do that, most of the time, you're going to be all right. At the very least, all of the time, you won't lose money. In other words, these exceptions that occur most of the time, if you follow them from the get-go, if you follow the rules, you know, whether we want to use that as an analogy for society or not in general, but if you follow the rules, you won't get hurt. It's when you decide to break the rule that you introduce the element of chance. That now it's like, okay, most of the time this ain't gonna work out for you, but if it does work out for you, you're gonna be in a really good position, right? Because no one thinks you have 2-7 offsuit or whatever. It's like playing a lottery. Look, man, you're not gonna win.
You won't win if you keep it up.
Yeah, the statement "you're not gonna win" doesn't mean no one ever wins. Obviously, some people do. The statement is, from probability we were talking, your chance of winning, it's not going to happen, right? Once you break the rule and start giving them money, you got to remember, it's not going to happen. However, if it does, you're going to be in a really good position. But if you had followed the rule, you would not have lost anything, you know? So that's where we're at.
No, that's a really good point about like rules where, yeah, maybe sometimes you'll get lucky, but if you follow it, you can make your own luck in other ways.
Right. I think, like, I was reading about this experiment they had did, I think, in the 90s, where they taught investors how to invest, and it was remarkably simple. All they had to do was follow these rules, detach themselves from their emotional states of winning and losing, and just follow these rules, and they all did well. They all beat the market, right? Yeah. I think they stopped the program for some reason, but it was really interesting to read about. I wish I could remember where I was, because it was a book. It wasn't a website, but
You know, actually, it's an interesting topic about you know, choosing where to bet, choosing what sorts of bets to make, because there, in tweets, blog posts, YouTube videos, anything like that, where you're producing a bunch of them, you know, and some things get popular, they've all been, I've seen, analogized to, you know, each time you make a tweet, each time you make a blog post or a video, whatever, you're buying a lottery ticket. Because everyone sees this, that, like, there'll be a few tweets, a few posts, a few videos, whatever, that are wildly more popular than the rest. And that introduces you to a bunch of people.
Right.
And so those are, in a metaphorical sense, those are buying lottery tickets. But the nice thing about that is there isn't, as long as you're not, like, trying really, really hard to be edgy to the point where you might, you know, then insult everybody, as long as you're, you know, on some sort of vaguely positive topic, those are lottery tickets that won't blow up in your face.
Right.
Unlike what you're, you know, I'm not familiar with poker. I kind of vaguely got the, I got the very, very basic idea of what
you got describing. The idea is that there are some good moves and some bad moves. But once you make a bad move, you got to remember, man, you are opening it up for the universe to come in and punish you, right?
Yeah.
As I always say, the law of large numbers is going to catch up to you eventually. So,
yeah.
You got to decide what to do. But I really like that. I don't think I've ever heard that about viewing each thing you put out as kind of a lottery ticket, and that leads me to this idea I talked to. Because my whole mindset about making money and building myself up in a certain way has changed a lot over the past year and a half, and mostly by accident. I've always just wanted to write and tweet, and then I really got to see and understand the power of the internet, and I'm like, and I think in terms of like gifts, talents, where I can compete at the top 10% level, I think I can do that in teaching and explaining things. I think for whatever reason, that's where my natural gift is. And for a long time, I resisted that. And I resisted it for silly reasons. The reasons aren't important. But the point is, that's where I can do well. And the internet is a very powerful medium for delivering any message or idea I have. But it's not a secure medium. What I mean is that a lot of people, I think you get to make a choice. And or maybe you don't even get to make the choice. I think maybe it's a mindset or whatever. But my mindset has changed, so I know you can choose and decide. You can chase security. And security is not a bad route to chase. This is not how I feel about either one. This is just observing a path and the possible pros and cons of each. You can chase security, and on the path of security, there is someone that will pay you a paycheck every 2 weeks. You probably get your health insurance taken care of. There will be some work, and you might not get a chance to do what you want, but that's not what you're chasing. You're chasing someone else giving you a task. You're chasing employment. You're letting them take the risk of hiring you, building, networking, growing, and all you're doing is being a cog in the machine. The cog in the machine has no risk. Heck, the only risk the cog in the machine has is breaking that cog specifically. And you know, they just replace you. The machine has to keep going. It's like they say about a coach and his players are on a more street level, like a pimp and his hoes. Like, you can, the players leave, the girls leave, the coach and the pimp, they're in the game forever, whether it's good or bad. Mm. That's the other end, freedom, right? Mm. No one is going to give you anything at this point. You got to make it and deal with it and build it yourself. But you get to work on your own projects. The potential is much greater for some kind of compensation because you're not capped by the person that has brought you in. You get to take risk without protection. And that's good because risk are the only way. I mean, I hate that risk has such a negative connotation with it. But all it is you're making decisions, but the outcome is not guaranteed. That's it.
Yeah, people get in a lot of trouble treating it like they're making decisions where the outcome is guaranteed.
Right, that's where the problem is. And
treating risk as a sure thing is...
Treating risk as a sure thing is a way for bad things to happen. So, I never thought about that way. Yeah, you get a lot... So you get to choose. You know, whichever way you choose, you just got to suck it up. Like you choose the path of freedom, man, look, I don't know why people talk about health insurance, like private health insurance wasn't a thing. It's always been there. It just costs more, but that's the cost of doing business. You know, on the flip side, you know, you got an employee, your health insurance is always there, but good luck if you want to travel somewhere and decide you don't want to work that day. You got to come up with something, because now you're secure, someone's taking care of you and giving something back. So those are the trade-offs on which way you're going to go with it. And with the whole Twitter thing that and the whole blog and YouTube, everything you build, there's no security. You can do other things that will make it more likely for you to succeed, but you're free. And then when they don't work, you swim and do something else, you know. There's a guy, Victor Prada, following on Twitter. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but in his book, New World Rona, he talks about being a shark versus being a ghost. And the ghosts are the ones that are the chasing security, and the sharks are the ones that are chasing freedom. But the thing about being a shark is you can never stop moving, because if a shark stops moving, a shark dies. So you always have to move. Mm. You always got to work on something. You always got to be up moving. I mean, that's why every day I wake up so energized. I mean, today I went back to sleep because I knew I was coming to talk to you today at 9. I was like, man, I'm going to get a little extra sleep, and I'm tutoring this afternoon, and I was up till midnight doing another thing. So I'm going to go back to sleep. But my body, I don't even use an alarm anymore. I swear to goodness, and I'm so happy this happened. Every day without fail, I'm out of 5:30 at the latest. Without an alarm, because I'm just excited. But I got to be excited, man. I have to keep moving. I got to keep working on stuff. Otherwise, I'll perish. And I don't want to go back to being. I don't want to go back to being secure. I don't know.
Yeah, it's well, and you know, life often has its stages too, because you know, there are different things appropriate to a young man than to like, you know, a mature man in his 50s than to, you know, an old man in his 70s. Right. So I mean, you know, a lot of life too. Like I've noticed a lot of people seem to want to have like universal, incredibly simple rules that govern absolutely everything, so that if I know these three things, I know all of life.
If life is so beautiful and simple, right? then we'd all have everything we want.
Yeah, but you know, there are things appropriate to different stages in life, and it's fine to do something where, like, I'm doing this now for the next few years. You know, for myself, like, I have trouble getting the time to read books. Mm-hmm. You know, with three little kids, you know, full-time job, three little kids around the house and so on, like, it's really, really hard to get some time when I still actually have a bit of energy to actually think and pay attention to things, because, you know, after work I get yelled at for, you know, a few hours until the kids finally go to sleep. You know, sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways, you know, there's, Dad, he took my this! There's also, Dad, you've got to come see this!
Yeah.
You know, there's everything. So, and I kind of just made peace with the fact, like, I'm not getting very much read right now. Because, I mean, I used to read, you know, voraciously. And when my kids are a bit older, I'm going to go back to reading. Because, yeah. I mean, I've got a reading list that's building up and up. And, you know, I'm going to get to it. But, like, now, at this point in my life, this is just not the time when I'm getting much read. I'm getting, you know, little read. You know, I can read Twitter, can read blog posts, you know. Every once in a while, I can read a bit of a book. But, like, it's something I've just had to make peace with, that right now, you know, for the last 2-3 years, probably for 2-3 more years, this is not the stage in my life when...
You're going to give a lot of reading time.
Yeah, it just isn't. You know, I work on making longbows. You can... they're out of frame. Like
this one. Oh, man, that's cool.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, carbon fiber backed. Takedown bows this way if the limbs break the... this is one of my favorites. Speaking of learning from failure, this is my first carbon fiber experiment where the only thing I cared about was, will the carbon fiber actually stick to the wood? And I made this thick enough. This thing probably had like a... This particular one is poplar. Had probably in excess of a 90-pound draw weight. And then if you look, you can see the wood actually had a compressive failure. Because for those who don't know, the this side, is the bow bends like this. This side's under tension, this side's under compression.
Yeah.
It actually compressively failed where the wood fibers crushed on the side. Because poplar's not a strong wood. It's not the right wood to make. It's really cheap, though, which is why I tried. But yeah, so like, I get to work on making my longbow something like once every 2 months for a few hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot you can get done if you're okay with not having, you know, with not making the progress quickly.
That's a...
I found.
Huh. See, that's a brilliant tweet right there. There's a lot you can get done You're okay with not making that progress quickly. See?
That's a good point.
And all you did was just saying how you think that. That's why writing is so important, man. Writing and speaking. It really builds the ability to manipulate words skillfully. And the more skill you have with a thing, the more efficient you are with it. The more efficient you are with it, the more you accomplish with less input. So in other words, you take a big jumbled mess of thoughts, that's your input, your output is Twitter. If you continue to become efficient with words, that jumbled mess of thought comes out real clean in 140 characters, and then it's just habit. And then it crosses over and everything else. So I'm telling you right now, I don't know the difference between my words and Twitter, because they're one. I don't know anymore. I'm so happy to have been born in 1985, because that means right now I'm alive for Twitter. Boom.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. There's I'm very happy to live in the age where I can be a programmer and carbon fiber exists.
Right.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean in a broad
imagine
sense.
Imagine being around and one of the, what was the British had the longbowman? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's,
you know why I know that too, which is crazy. I don't know if you ever played Age of Empires, man. We were big fans of Age of Empires.
I haven't gotten a chance. I heard of it.
And the unique unit for the British were the long bowmen.
Yeah.
Yeah. The greatest range in the game.
Yeah. Oddly enough, much better range than crossbows, longbows.
Right. And without knowing anything about archery, but knowing physics, that makes perfect sense. I would imagine a crossbow is much more accurate, but a longbow we should have far and away the same, like a greater range. It's not even
close. Yeah, well, interestingly too, because the thing about modern crossbows anyway, because like at the archery shop I go to, they sell a lot of crossbows. Crossbows are extremely accurate up to around 50 yards, but the thing is, they use very short bolts. You know, instead of arrows, they're called bolts.
Right.
They're very short and relatively light. So they go super fast, because, you know, the crossbow's got a lot of power to it, because you use mechanical advantage to conk the thing back. But the thing is, after about 50 yards, because they're so light, they lose a lot of speed, and then, like, the air effects actually start to dominate. They lose a lot of accuracy in them, whereas arrows being you know, much longer and generally heavier things, an arrow will be accurate to much further distance. Crossbows will be very easily accurate within about 50 yards, is what I'm told, for like modern equipment. Mm-hmm. What the guy said is, you know, you'll be dead on accurate to about 50 yards. I would not recommend shooting much past that, because then they start to get fairly inaccurate. Because there are things like the fletchings are really close to the front, so they don't steer as well. Because the fletchings help to keep the tail aligned and so on.
Right. Are those the things that the fins?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's funny, man. How you just learn to see the world differently based on what you learn. I always wonder like what those were, and then I was looking. I was like, why would I put, when I was looking at your bow, I was like, why would I put a fin on the back of an object flying past? Oh, okay, well the air is going to split, but if I have it equally spaced, then the splits are going to balance each other out and keep the bow more accurate. They're going to negate the effect of wind.
It's also funny too, they actually the fletchings are actually slightly, they're not perfectly straight, they're actually turned slightly, so they actually induce rotation in the arrow to spin stabilize the thing as it goes. But anyway, yeah, not to go too far afield. Actually, one last thing, because we've been talking for a long time and probably should wrap up. But one last thing I'm very curious about, you know, especially as you mentioned almost the point of thinking in Twitter.
Yeah.
Or, you know, speaking in Twitter in a sense. I'm curious how... because, like there's certain language that you use. I'm trying to think the simple way to describe it. I mean, you use a lot of variants of and I probably won't pronounce this quite correctly, but use a lot of variants of the word nigga. I'm not sure precisely how to pronounce it, because it's not a word I'm familiar with. on the other hand, I'm also not willing to act like I'm, you know, talking to 3-year-olds and saying
right.
the N-word.
No, you're right, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not a word I use, but on the other hand, when speaking to adults, I just like to speak like an adult.
Right.
But so, like you use, you know, many variants of that in other terms. And so, I mean, how much is that just, you know, habit? How much of that is, you know, consciously choosing?
Okay, so some points, because as you become more aware of how a person receives a message, some things I like to say a certain way. I'll tell you this, almost nothing I do is an accident.
It was kind of guessing.
And certainly not on a digital medium where I can edit and go back. I'm not, no, very deliberate choice of words. Because I know that some ideas are going to be better received towards a better audience and express the idea better. Sometimes it'll be a self-selecting filter. It'll depend who I'm retweeting. It all depends. But if I was to give you a TLDR of how my mind works on the selection of drop a nigga in certain tweets, my mind goes, is someone likely to use this to analyze a life lesson, or is someone likely to use this to analyze a street lesson? What I mean, when I say life lesson, that is a super general point or perception or observation about a thing that a person would not have, that a person would have without my background. But anything that I've learned or experienced with my background, and I want to specifically draw attention to my background about it, then I drop nigga in the tweet. Or I'm trying to make a joke about something. So that's pretty much how my mind works. If I'm thinking, okay, would you have gained this insight without it? And sometimes it's contrast, like a heavy contrast, just to... But in general, like I'm getting a better and better feel for what people will pick up on as contrast and what people won't pick up on as contrast. Like for example, I did, you know, there's this joke I'll do occasionally where I will say a thing and then quote a figure, but it's so obvious that the figure wouldn't have said it that people get the joke on referencing a certain thing. Like a quote, we can handle this like gentlemen, or we can get into some gangster shit, Martin Luther King Jr., right? Or there's a line from this Biggie song, the 10 Crack Commandments, where he goes, if you ain't getting bags, stay the fuck from police. If you ain't getting if niggas think you're snitching, they ain't trying to listen, Hillary Clinton, right? So, like, the whole point, you know, it's a real feel thing, but the 80% of it is, are these insights that you would have without me, without my background, without my life. And I know that's weird, because, like, how could you have them if you weren't me? But is it something a person from the hood would not get or not understand? Let me throw it one way. If you have any kind of urban environment history and it just makes more sense to say it a certain way, then it's that way. Are my jokes, contradictions, quotes, etc. So, but once again, holistically, in my real speech, it's about right here. 80% of the time, I never use it. 20% of the time, I do. And of that 20% of the time, sometimes I'm talking to people from my similar background. Sometimes I'm making a point, telling a joke, contrast. So once again, there's that blur that's happened. Twitter is how I speak. How I speak is Twitter. You know. So.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie Patton by any chance?
Like General Patton?
Yeah, the George C. Scott play.
I haven't seen it, though, but I don't...
It's a fun movie. I do recommend it. Patton was... do you know the history of General Patton in World War II?
Right, okay. I had to remember which war. And then now everything is flowing back to me.
Yeah, it was a tank commander. And a friend of mine actually got interested in him. Apparently he was actually one of the people who developed the concept of tank warfare. Like, the strategy and the basic strategy and tactics of tank warfare. But he, one of the curious things about him is he was known for using a lot of, vulgar language, but, you know, fuck and shit and so on,
yeah.
in his speeches to his troops. And there's a memorable one about how, where he was an introductory lecture to his troops, say, talking about, like, fire the bullets in your gun. And he's talking about, like, I promise you, if you actually fire your gun, you're going to make it through. If you simply sit there and don't do anything, those are the people who get killed. But it was laced with colorful euphemisms, and I forget exactly where he would throw it in, but apparently he was also, he could be a quite refined gentleman. And so he didn't compulsively use that sort of language. He just thought it made things much more memorable to his troops. And especially right. when he was trying to give a lesson that would save people's lives, he wanted them to remember it. And so he thought that if a general is telling you, fire your fucking gun, this would actually stick in your head, you know, while you're there. Because World War II is primarily a conscript army. And, you know, you're a farm boy from somewhere, and the general tells you, fire your fucking gun. You might actually, even in the heat of the moment, remember, like, you're supposed to actually do something with the gun.
Right.
And so, you know, save your life. So I've always found that concept interesting, that in some contexts, using, you know, profanity generally can make things more memorable. So
a good communicator understands, right? So I want to say good, great, border, good, great. As your communication improves, that's better. As your communication improves, you realize that all that matters is how the other person perceives what you say. Your meaning, I think that's actually a good gauge of how developed your communication abilities are. Do you think what you meant matters? Right? If you do, you got some ways to go. If you are focusing on how it's going to be received, remembered, and interpreted, yeah, now you're at the right. Now you're thinking correctly. Now you can do a thing, because now you're not worried about, now it's not a selfish thing. Now it's, I need to express this idea and I need them to understand it. How can I make sure they understand it? This is good teaching. This is why teaching styles are BS. Good teachers to mediocre teachers have teaching styles. Great teachers understand that all that matters is, does the student get it? Does the student understand? Did I express it in a way? And if they don't understand, how can we talk and learn? That's the other thing. Interesting, because you don't have to be perfect at the concept, but you have to buy into the concept to get perfect at it, mm-hmm. right? If you're resisting this idea and you think, well, what matters more is what you meant to say, and it's therefore, then you can never excel. You can never move past a certain point. But once you go, okay, how can I make sure they understand? And how I say it is irrelevant. All that matters is, do they get it? Do they remember? Do they follow the order? Do they listen? Do they learn from me? Mm-hmm. Then you can start formulating everything around that. And then a magical thing happens. People respond to you and you get more of what you wanted in the first place. That's like, give value, you get more back.
That's yeah. simple. It's also interesting thinking like somebody listening to you. You know, yeah. to put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's actually listening to
you. It's amazing how few people, I mean, like no one does this.
Well, it's even harder to put yourself in the shoes of somebody who doesn't know what you know, because it's not easy to forget what you know.
Oh, yeah. Look, man, I always say, people who can overcome the curse of knowledge have a moral obligation to teach. Like, because it's so hard to do it, and we need people that I don't even want to say can remember what it's like to be a beginner, because even that's too much. You have to always be able to put in your mind that a person just doesn't have your frame of reference. You have to get them to a frame of reference. You have to go to their frame of reference, wherever, and then you start speaking to them on their terms. And if you can do that, man, I always say the world has a lot for you. You can take complicated and make it simple. And part of doing that is communicating it in the way that the person will receive it.
Mm. Yeah. You know, actually, it's funny about evaluating teachers. I saw this in a martial arts context when I was trying to get into martial arts 20 years ago. I was reading some very interesting advice, which is, you know, I was looking into Kung Fu, so I was really interested in at the time. And they're explaining, don't look at how good the teacher is. Because the teacher might be good or bad, but that's how good they are at learning.
Yeah.
Look at their students. If they have really, really good students, that means they're good at the teacher is good right. at teaching. And they may the teacher may not be very good at learning. He doesn't have to be, because you're not him. You just want to learn from him.
I wrote a blog. I don't know, because I wrote it on my old blog. I don't know if I put it over to this one about that very same concept when you're selecting a coach. Because I've seen a lot more coaches than the average boxer in my career length has had because of some things that happened with my amateur career. But I've always said that you need to look at the results of the students to gauge how good someone is. And the more you know about the sport in general, you can gauge the ability of the people who are performing. You know, because it's one thing to see some guy with a title. What does that mean? Maybe he got a great student and he just happened to get lucky. But you want to see overall how everyone is grasping performance on the spectrum. But you want to only look at the performer. Who cares about the teacher? He could be the most ornery asshole ever, or he could be a super soft dude. Doesn't matter. What matters is that he somehow understands how to get everyone else to listen and to learn. And that's spot on. I have to send you that blog post.
Oh, yeah.
Dig it up.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for coming. It really has been a great pleasure talking with you.
Oh, man, you too.
Fascinating
man.
Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. And for anyone watching, until next time, may you hit everything you aim at.